In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. For 300 years, in every strata of human interaction, two societies existed separated within the nation that we now know as South Africa. First as a Dutch colony, and then later as perhaps the most far-flung realm of the British Empire. But even when the British Empire banned the slave trade, British Parliament deferred to the fact that South Africa had once been a Dutch colony and allowed its history of allowing two separate societies to exist to remain part of the law. And that persisted up until the 1940s, when the whole policy of apartheid became not just sort of a social phenomenon, but a politically codified way of separating whites from blacks, disenfranchising, among other things. And for those years in which apartheid existed, that allowed a state-sponsored way of persecution and allowed to commit some of the most heinous acts of violence upon one ethnicity. And that lasted until the 1990s. But when apartheid finally was lifted and the country was faced with the challenge of how to forge a new solidarity in the midst of a newfound diversity, respect for it, they had to ask themselves, what will be that process whereby we might forge a real and lasting forgiveness? But also, what must we do as a society in order to see one another with a proper sense of dignity? And a word surfaced from within the ranks of those trying to forge that new society, and that word was the word Ubuntu. For those of you who are computer programmers, Ubuntu is a programming language that takes its name from this very idea. Ubuntu means, literally, humanity. But compressed within the term of Ubuntu is the idea of what constitutes our humanity. It's not just strictly the definition of humanity, it's what constitutes it, what defines us as humans. And compressed within that notion of Ubuntu is the idea that we are not defined primarily by who we are individually, but who we are in terms of our relationships to one another. The we, not me, on the front of your bulletin is in some ways one of the slogans within the concept of Ubuntu, of trying to understand who we are, that we are individuals and we are unique in our own uniqueness as individuals, but we ought to primarily understand ourselves by virtue of who we are in relationship with one another. And that's why one of the, you might say, purveyors of the notion of Ubuntu within the Society of South Africa, Michael Onyebuchi Eze, has the first quote on the front of your bulletin, who says this: a person is a person through other people. That's Ubuntu. And the extent to which they embraced that notion would be the extent to which that society might be new again. We are in a series on the Sermon on the Mount. And today, I'll be really honest with you, the topic we are taking up is one that we have taken up on a number of occasions, even recently. On Good Friday, we talked about the vice of wrath. And a few weeks ago, we talked about the business of peacemaking. And in a lot of ways, what we're going to talk about today overlaps with those two themes. And so I'll say to you this, as I was preparing the sermon, I had to ask myself, what am I going to say to you that isn't new, or that is new, that what we haven't already said already and recently? It's this. Both what we talked about on Good Friday and what we talked about a few weeks ago, in the background of those two sermons, is what's in the foreground of this passage. And what's in the foreground of this passage is the reimagining of the importance of relationship. Relationship defines us. Relationship sustains us. And Jesus, as he is wont to do in the rest of this sermon, is out to reimagine the value of relationship, its primacy, its privilege, its preciousness. And so in order to understand how he's reimagining relationship, we want to consider two things that he's going to raise in this passage. What most ably disrupts relationship, and what most readily restores it. What most ably disrupts it, what will most readily restore it. We're still in our series in the Sermon on the Mount. We're in Matthew chapter 5. Would you stand? Matthew chapter 5, starting in verse 21. And you have heard it was said to those of old, "You shall not murder. Whoever murders shall be liable to judgment. But I say to you, whoever is angry with his brother shall be liable to judgment. Whoever insults his brother shall be liable to the council. Whoever says, 'You fool,' shall be liable to the hell of fire." So if you're offering your gift there at the altar and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift there at the altar and go. First be reconciled to your brother, then come and offer your gift. Make friends quickly with your accuser. Come to terms quickly with your accuser while you're going with him to a court, lest your accuser hand you over to the judge and the judge to the guard and you be put in prison. Truly, I say to you, you will never get out till you've paid the last penny. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. You may be seated. If you own a vintage car, you don't park it on the street at night. And when there's threat of hail, what do? You put it in the garage. Why? Because you value the preservation of that item. You know what most threatens it, so you protect it. If you're the parent of a small child, you don't let them wander into the road where vintage and other cars travel freely. Why? Because you value their preservation and you know what's going to harm them. And so you take measures to prevent that harm. Jesus is implicitly underscoring the value of relationship in this passage by identifying what most ably degrades and destroys them. And he does that by starting with an idea that everybody who's listening to him is familiar with. And then he asks them to kind of go on a journey with them, to press a little bit further into the full value of relationships that they might grasp it. He says, "You have heard that it was said to those of long ago, 'You shall not murder.'" Now, who's he quoting? You know, he's quoting the law of Moses, which is not Moses' law, that's God's law. Murder is lawbreaking. Murder is sin. And that they knew, that they'd been taught. They recognized, they recited, they memorized the Ten Commandments and other places. Taking a life, it's not a stretch to say, is the supreme devaluing of a human relationship, both of that person and of the relationship you have with them. But Jesus is asking them to consider in their minds, had they reckoned with what always underlies the act of murder? The prohibition of murder is ostensibly about the act of murder. It is. But if the murderous act really reveals something internal, like the devaluing of that person and the devaluing of that relationship, then he is saying, you're not hearing the law of Moses appropriately unless you hear what that law is really out to protect. Their life, to be sure, but relationship also. And Jesus is saying that what most ably diminishes and threatens our relationships is anger. Just garden of the moon, run-of-the-mill anger. Lots of things threaten relationships. We're going to be talking about those from the rest of the Sermon on the Mount, like lust, and infidelity, and a lack of integrity in your speech, and your own hypocrisy. All of those things will threaten and diminish and degrade your relationships. But what seeps into our relationships as easily as toxins seep into the groundwater is just anger. Now, again, if you've been with us over the last several months, you know that Jesus is not putting a full-scale moratorium on anger. If he had, he'd be a hypocrite. Because we all know, and we've documented, some of Jesus' angry moments. On Good Friday, he cleansed the temple. That was not with a smile on his face. When the Pharisees got angry with him that he healed a man on the Sabbath, Jesus was angry, and he didn't deal with a spring in his step. So Jesus is not calling on the carpet every outbreak of anger. In Greek, there are two words that are typically associated with the word anger. It's the word thumos and the word orge. Thumos has to do with anger that's kind of like straw that bursts into flame. It happens quick and it's over before you know it. That's thumos. That's one form of anger. The other form of anger is called orge. That's the word we have here in this passage. Orge refers to a sustained, brooding anger. It's like charcoal that lights and then subtly smolders until it reaches an intense heat. That's orge. That's what's here. And Jesus is saying, look, you can be concerned all you want about anger, I mean about murder, but you really need to be more concerned about orge, about anger that goes unattended and unsupervised and eventually unbridled. There is no murder without that kind of anger. And yet there are a host of things, just short of murder, that that kind of anger contributes to, and which makes anger as condemnable as murder. Why is he making such a big deal about this? Why are we talking about this again? We talked about wrath on Good Friday. We talked about blessed are the peacemakers a few weeks ago. Why is he going there again? Consider anger in just your relationship to yourself. I don't think this is new. I don't think this will be out of the world for you. I don't think it will be impossible to believe, but you are probably aware of the fact that there is now clinical research that makes a very clear correlation between internalized, unanalyzed, unresolved anger and heart disease, high blood pressure, chest pain, cardiovascular disease. It's not a wives' tale. It's not something that doctors say just to spook you. Anger that manifests icily as lips pursed together, knitted brows, voices raised, tight jaws, or, as some people like to do it, they may not show a sentiment of anger, but they'll bury it, and it's called stonewalling. And now there is evidence that that is killing you if you partake of it. He's concerned with anger because anger is killing your relationship to yourself. Jesus is bringing up anger because it's also what it does to another relationship. You have heard us before refer to the research of John Gottman. He's a noted marital expert. He has developed this uncanny ability to listen to recorded excerpts of a couple's talking, and he can tell within just 15 minutes of listening to their conversation with a high degree of accuracy whether or not that couple remained together or divorced in time. And it's because he has attuned his listening for one thing. And if he hears that one thing, he knows they're doomed. And that thing is contempt. Two people can be angry with each other. They can yell. They can pace. They can even throw objects. And while those forms of anger are worrisome, they are never as worrisome as the anger that turns into words that reveal how one or the both of them think of the other person. Some anger merely flares up. Contempt seethes. And the difference between just sort of your run-of-the-mill anger and contempt is that contempt takes anger to a new level by beginning to think of the other person as inferior to themselves. That's contempt. And where it's permitted to grow, it's a death sentence. Why is Jesus bringing up anger? Because it's killing your relationships and your marriages. What it does to our bodies, what it does to our relationships, on that alone, we might realize, okay, Jesus, I get it. But Jesus does not limit the consequences of anger to just our health or relational duress. He is saying this kind of anger makes one liable to nothing less than the judgment of God. You heard the evocative language. Whoever is angry with his brother is liable to judgment. Whoever insults his brother is liable to the council. Whoever says, you fool, is liable to the hell of fire. Jesus is using three phrases to essentially say one thing. You're not just answerable to your body. You're not just answerable to your marriage. You're answerable to God for your anger. Those references of insulting, those references of calling your brother a fool, that's the language of contempt. Those words are not just expressing disagreement. Those are what the Latins call ad hominem, where you're out to defame someone and degrade them. That stuff will kill your body, it'll kill your relationship, and it's going to open yourselves to judgment. That's not hyperbolic language Jesus is using. All right. In your high school physics class, you learned a category about energy in two separate states. You learned in physics the difference between potential energy and kinetic energy. Potential energy is what my phone has right now on the top of this lectern. If I were to push it over the edge, that potential energy would suddenly become kinetic energy. You would see it, and it would be over. In Israel's hearing of the law of Moses, they had thought that there is no kinetic energy until you murder someone. Until then, anything before murder is just sort of potential energy, and it's no big deal. But Jesus is challenging that sensibility. The potential energy is the kinetic energy. The anger unresolved is the anger chosen and already active. It's already kinetic. And that's why he will equate anger and murder. And in that always energized state, anger is the simplest, ablest way to undermine a relationship. Now, great. That's really sobering news. I get it. And I have to hear that. So where's the hope? If it's that easy for something that simple that happens so very readily in any given day, in any given relationship, what's going to restore it? That's the last half of this sermon. We've talked about what most ably disrupts it. Now we want to talk about what most readily restores it. I'm going to give you three words that Jesus sort of summarizes here that summarize what it means to restore a relationship. Three words: priority, urgency, and a whole theology. Priority, urgency, and a whole theology. First, let's talk about priority. The hope you have of restoring in a relationship rests on whether or not you see it as a priority. Jesus gives us two scenes, two illustrations here, the first of which has to do with somebody standing in the temple, coming to do their holy work, coming to worship, coming to offer, coming to see whatever, to be with one another, to take the sacrament, whatever it might have been. And then Jesus says this startling thing about this person that's come to this holy corridor, this temple. He says, if anybody has anything against you, get out of there. Stop it. Lay your gift down and go. And you know what he says? He doesn't even specify if what that person has against you is justifiable. He just says, if they have in their minds a sense that you've done them wrong, get up, get out, go to them. And what he's implying in his directive is that our worship is in some ways invalidated if we have not made the effort to set things right with someone who thinks we've wronged them. He's saying, obversely, that our worship is in fact legitimized by our efforts to restore the relationship. That's why I've got another quote for you on the front of your bulletin from F.D. Bruner. He says this: one of the major purposes of worship is to remind us of relationships. If worship is us communing with God, then surely communing has something to do with the rest of our existence. It has to do with our relationship to Him. Why would you think He would compartmentalize that with your relationship with others? He doesn't. Let me talk to kids in the room right now. Kids, I have a few kids in my house. Sometimes, as hard as it will be for you to recollect this, sometimes they get angry with each other. It may be that if you were not the only kid in your house, that you might get angry with each other. Even the kids who are now young adults in this room can probably tell you stories of being angry with one another from time to time. Maybe even today. It happens, and it will happen. But what Jesus is saying to you kids and to me and to every adult in this room about anger is this. He's saying, you might get angry, but you can't stay angry. He's saying you might even have a good reason to be angry. They took your food. They broke your toy. They smashed your finger in the door. Whatever it might have been. Any of all of those things might have made you angry, and you might have good reason to be angry. But Jesus is saying there is something more important than you feeling angry, even if you have a right to be angry. He is saying your relationship with the one you're angry with is more important than you being angry with them. It always will be that way. And he's especially talking to the person who might have made somebody angry. He's saying to the person who did wrong that they need to do whatever they need to do in order to make it right with that person. Because the relationship is always more important than being angry at them for whatever reason that might be. I said I'm talking to the kids. I'm talking to everybody in this room. I'm talking to myself. There's hope for recovery when you see it as a priority. But secondly, Jesus is saying that there's a hope for recovery when you pursue it with urgency. And that we get from his second illustration, which the main distinction between each of the illustrations he gives us is mainly about with whom you are responsible to make amends. In this illustration of the temple, he talks about our relationship with our fellow brethren who come and live and are submissive before the same God. But in this illustration, in the second illustration, he's talking about our responsibility in relationship with anyone. Anyone. Whether they believe God or not. And so the scene he paints is a person accused of a crime. A kind of a crime that adjudication is called for by a judge. And the accused has been, so to speak, subpoenaed. And so there's a process that's now underway. And Jesus is saying, if you value relationship, you will get out in front of the process that's underway. You won't merely let the process just sort of follow its course and you be a passive participant in that process, especially if you're the one at fault. The key phrase in the illustration is, come to terms quickly. Make this right, but do it quickly. Why? In a sense, Jesus is appealing to our own self-interest. If you let the process go forward, if you let the system get involved, you're only asking for a longer and more costly way of working this out. If you think it's going to cost you in terms of humbling yourself before another to get it right before the court registers opinion, imagine what it's going to cost you when it does register its opinion. I tell you the truth, Jesus says, you're not going to get out till you paid the last penny. It's to your benefit to seek restoration of a relationship with a fellow citizen before the system does, because it's going to cost you if you let it go there. Let me put it this way. I love counselors. I've seen counselors. I've sometimes needed counselors. Counselors are good things. But if it's come to that, it means that there's been a host of moments that I've let go right on by, where instead of me taking the initiative to try to figure out a way to be in strength and in sync and in congruity and in reconciliation with whomever I'm estranged from, if I've let those moments go by, it would have cost me a lot less to take that initiative then than it's now going to cost me to go seek a counselor. As good as that is, as helpful that is, as sometimes as needful as that may be, Jesus is talking about an urgency. And he's appealing to our self-interest, but he's not only appealing to our self-interest. The urgency with which you seek restoration is not what you're due. It's what whoever is accusing you is due. Who they are demands your respect, because you're made in the image of God, and so are they. And the relationship you have to them as one human to another requires a sense of urgency to come to terms with them quickly, that they and their dignity deserve your urgency. There's hope for recovery of relationship when it's seen as a priority and when it's pursued with urgency. But both that priority and that urgency presuppose one other thing. What they presuppose is a whole theology of why we're doing what we're doing. Familiarity can breed contempt. You've heard that. More often, it can breed blindness. It can breed aloofness. It can breed passivity. You just get in a rut, and you kind of just sort of learn to live with the estrangement. But in the first verse of the passage, you heard the first of six instances where Jesus does something that would have made everybody's eyes go very wide. He says, "You have heard that it was said to those of long ago, but I say to you." Why is that important? When Abraham gets to the top of Mount Moriah with Isaac, and Isaac says, "Where's the sacrifice?" Abraham says, "The Lord has told me He will give us a sacrificial animal." When Moses comes down from the mountain with the tablets, he says, "The Lord gave these to me for you." And every single prophet who has something to say to Israel will say to a man, "Thus saith the Lord." What does Jesus say? "You've heard that it was said to those of old, but I say to you." Okay. That's unprecedented. A lot of people will say that whoever wrote that John's gospel sort of embellished the picture of Jesus to make him look more fully divine, and that the rest of the gospel authors just sort of preferred to cast Jesus in terms of one who was a wise sage who came as a prophet of God. But brothers and sisters, if that were true, then for Jesus to say, "Hey, you've heard it said, but I say to you," then he is truly blaspheming, because he is making himself equal with God. For Jesus to introduce that is not just to introduce an ethic. It's to do theology in real time. It's to speak of his divine authority. And how, then, does theology inform our priority and our urgency in restoring relationship? Just think of the doctrine of the Trinity for a second. The doctrine of the Trinity tells us that God, from all eternity, has been in relationship. And therefore, relationship is not subsidiary to the nature of God, it's central. Our understanding of the Trinity upholds the centrality of relationship. Think about the doctrine of creation. God creates, and then what does God do? Go away? No. He creates to commune. And therefore, relationship is central to understanding of the doctrine of creation. The doctrine of sin. Even when we violate the communion with God and say to ourselves, "We know better, we can do better," what does God do? He makes an effort to restore the relationship, and you will hear more times than you can count God saying this promise: "I'll be your God, you'll be my people." What is that? It's not the language of ownership, it's the language of relationship. The doctrine of the Trinity, the doctrine of creation, the doctrine of sin. If we just listen to those doctrines, that theology, it would be enough for us to say relationship matters so much that we ought to forge new reconciliation. Brothers and sisters, you and I know that the creme de la creme, the par excellence matter of theology that underscores this reason for our desire to be reconciled to one another is this: the doctrine of salvation. God severs one relationship to reconcile another. He, in effect, treats his own son as an outcast in order to bring we who are outcasts in to commune with him, to be in relationship with him. In Jesus going to his cross, he, if you will, leaves a holy place and enters into an accursed place. Why? That we might be reconciled to God. He leaves the temple and makes himself the gift. He pays the last penny by giving up his dying breath. All so that you and I can talk to God freely. All that so that you and I can delight and be delighted in by God freely. All so that we might be in relationship with God. Jesus gives up his relationship to his Father for a season that we might have one with his Father forever. And then both he and his Father send us a portion of himself to dwell within us, that we might commune with him, that we might have something that resides within us to remind us that we are his irrevocably. The concept of Ubuntu assumes an inherent dignity in humanity, which derives from a mutual responsibility to one another. That's what Ubuntu assumes and asserts. Brothers and sisters, it's the God of heaven who establishes that, though. Jesus, in this passage, most profoundly at his cross, bears witness to the dignity that demands the valuing of relationships. If I could condense everything that Jesus has had to say and all that we have had to say, it will be what St. John Chrysostom says on the front of your bulletin. It's the second quote. He says, "There is nothing for which God takes so much pains as this, that we should be united and knit together one with another." If that's true, if that be so, if we are children of a king who spared nothing to reconcile us to himself, and if in his effort to reconcile us to God and to each other, we are in fact defined in large part by who we are to one another, then I'm asking you this. Is there somebody in this body, in this moment right now, that you're at odds with? Is there someone in your workplace? Is there someone under your roof? Is there someone at your school? Is there someone in your neighborhood that would need to call you to account for some way in which you might have violated or damaged that relationship? So far as it depends on you, have you gone to them? Have you gone to them with priority and with urgency and with this theology in tow? If you're married, is there something that you haven't talked about that you need to talk about? Kids, I'll say it again. Is there someone who's mad at you in your family or at your school or on your street, and have you gone to them to seek their forgiveness? This happens at every level of human interaction, and it even happens at the institutional level, and this denomination has just spent the whole last week asking this question. What have we done historically and corporately for 40 years to treat others as if they are inferior to us, who might be different from us? What must we do if they have something against us? What must we do to set things right? That's our denomination's question to ourselves. That's the question that every human under the sun must ask themselves who are in him. In closing, let me give you a little window into what I did last Sunday while you were here. While you were having church, I gathered my family around a picnic table on a beach, and we had 10-minute church. And some of you wish you could join that church, I know. And there was sand all around us. So I got them to get a cup of sand, and I had Jedediah count the grains of sand. He got to 20. And I said, "What was Abraham's promise? To make Israel as numerous as the sands of the sea." And then I had them read the conclusion to Jesus' Sermon on the Mount about building your house on the rock or on the sand. And how do we build our house on the rock, I asked them? By following what he has said. And then I said, "One thing that this family might be well to do is to remember what my youngest son had recited just a few weeks ago when he said, 'Blessed are the peacemakers, for they should be called sons of God.'" And I concluded our 10-minute church with a little poem from William Cowper. He wrote a poem called "The Nightingale and the Glowworm." It's about the songbird who got hungry and saw the lit up glowworm and thought to myself, "Dinner and a show." And as he proceeded to come to that glowworm, the glowworm speaks up, who knew glowworms could speak, and says, pleading for his life unto the songbird, "For 'twas the selfsame power divine taught you to sing and me to shine, that you with music, I with light, might beautify and cheer the night." But Cooper ends that poem in an ode to reconciliation, saying this: "Hence jarring sectaries may learn their real interest to discern, that brother should not war with brother and worry and devour each other, but sing and shine by sweet consent till life's poor transient night is spent, respecting in each other's case the gifts of nature and of grace. Those Christians best deserve the name who studiously make peace their aim, peace both the duty and the prize of him that creeps and him that flies." Brothers and sisters, there is neither time nor point for you to bear a grudge in this life. The relationship matters more, and so does Jesus. Amen.